And that jarring cacophony, bloody hell, it's starting to get cold in here. Tells you that
I'm not putting the heating on. Fasten up your hoodie.
Hang on. That was my hoodie being zipped up, nothing else.
Yes, right, okay.
Not that kind of podcast, people.
Yes, no, because I'm here and I'm imposing a limit on a smut. You better introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Kenny Smith. You're listening to the Power of Three podcast.
And I'm David Steele. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. It's day 7 of our little countdown to the new series beginning, featuring Millie Gibson and...
Shooty Gatwa.
I don't know. IDK. GIF of little girl going like that. IDK. And it's day 7, which obviously means it's a story featuring Sylvester McCoy, the 7th Doctor. And we've chosen a new adventure, or I should say, Kenny selected a new adventure. Do you want to tell the kids which one we've gone
for? Yeah, well, given how blooming freezing it is as we sit here with our parkas on, I mean, we actually are recording at the South Pole today in Antarctica, which probably doesn't help. But yes, we are going to chat about Iceberg by David Banks. Now, you may recognise the name David Banks, David.
Yes, of course, because the name David Banks, he was ubiquitous in when you were a Doctor Who fan in the 80s, because he played, of course, the Cyber Leader. He was in Earthshock, he was in The Five Doctors, he was in Attack of the Cybermen, he was in Nemesis, he was around all the time. And, of course, he played kinky bondage gear-wearing space pirate Carl in Doctor Who The Ultimate Adventure. I point to my original Ultimate Adventure poster, which is on the wall over there, featuring John Z.P., God bless him. 35 years since The Ultimate Adventure.
That's terrifying.
Oh my,
this month.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, well, yeah.
May.
Well, that was May when it was in Glasgow, but it started before that. Oh my God, The Ultimate Adventure's 35 years old. We should get David back on and ask him about The Ultimate Adventure. Anyway, yes, David, obviously, because he played the Cyber Leader, he got quite into it. I remember Christmas 1989 getting the hardback of his Cyberman book.
It was excellent.
It really was. It had a lot of really interesting stuff in it. David was obviously inspired because he wrote an original Doctor Who novel which featured the Cybermen, and this is what the back cover blurb says. "Depends on how you define alien," the Doctor said simply. "They were human once." In 2006, the world is about to be overwhelmed by a disaster that might destroy human civilization, the inversion of the Earth's magnetic field. Deep in an Antarctic base, the Flipback team is frantically devising a system to reverse the change in polarity. Above them, the SS Elysium carries its jet-set passengers on the ultimate cruise. On board is Ruby Duval, a journalist sent to record the Flipback moment. Instead, she finds a man called the Doctor, who is locked out of the strange green box he says is merely a part of his time machine. And she finds old enemies of the Doctor, silver giants at work beneath the ice. This book has the Doctor Who 30th anniversary little flash on the back, because it came out in 1993, and the blurb continues. Full-length original novels based on the longest-running science fiction television series of all time, the BBC's Doctor Who, the new adventures take the TARDIS into previously unexplored realms of space and time. As an actor, David Banks is best known as the obsessive lawyer Graham Curtis from Brookside, as well as for his portrayal of the Cyber Leader in Doctor Who throughout the 80s. Iceberg is his third book. The first, the highly acclaimed Cybermen, might best be described as an insider's guide to the cyber race.
Excellent.
I got that book, the cyber book, at The Ultimate Adventure when David was selling it afterwards, and I got my copy then and I got it signed.
Wonderful.
It's a great book. I still look at it with a lot of fondness. I've got mine on my shelf.
I can see mine. I can look round. Yes, listeners, I carted my entire living room to the South Pole to record this episode. Cost me a fortune in boxes. Yes, it'll be over there. Iceberg, I have to be brutally honest, I have very mixed feelings about this one when I read it. I found it a little uneven, and I was kind of surprised at how little the Cybermen ended up being involved. That's my lingering memory of when I read. I would have read it probably when about this time 30 years ago, so it was early summer. 1994 was probably when I read it. What were your thoughts?
Well, I'm a huge Cybermen fan. They are my favourite monsters. I prefer them to Daleks. Ice Warriors are my second favourite, incidentally, and then it's the Daleks. That's kind
listeners, what are your top three Doctor Who monsters? Email the earth2podcast@gmail.com and tell Peter. You've got nothing better to do tonight.
You know you want to. But anyway. No, I mean, remember it was... There was very little of the Doctor in it to start with. We do get him on his journey as he's sort of leaving the TARDIS, and we get him sort of... We get... And we're privy to quite a lot of his thoughts, and there's an awful lot of Far Eastern sort of philosophy coming into it, which is quite interesting, and we get an awful lot of time with Ruby DeVal. Now, when this book came out, I was a student journalist back in 1993, so I was very interested in Ruby, and the fact that history is very interesting when you look at the sort of the technological advances, because Ruby has got effectively a very advanced dictaphone, which is effectively an iPod.
Yeah, it's interesting sort of that it was set, you know, 13 years in the future. How much do you think technology has overtaken, or how authentic do you think is... his 2006 predictions were?
I'd say it's pretty bang on. I mean, there's the thing that really comes through in this is the ecology aspect.
Right.
And it's very much, you know, there's a strong environmental message, which, of course, is a massive matter today with climate change, which was being talked about back then when it was being called global warming.
Mm-hmm.
But things have changed significantly since then,
mm-hmm.
as we know, as we're witnessing weather conditions that are very unusual. I had snow the other morning, Dave, when I woke up.
Yeah, but that's because you live in East Kilbride, which, you think, honestly, East Kilbride, listen, you think Axos would land here every 10 minutes, the way the weather goes up there sometimes.
I know, I think it's a very forward-thinking book, and I think that David was effectively taking a step back to look forwards, if that makes sense, and thinking about, okay, this is what we're doing now. What will the concerns be in the future? Quite a Kit Pedler way of thinking, actually, when you think that how the Cybermen came about is spare part technology and things like that.
Yeah.
And there's some really horrible moments in it when somebody gets his skull cracked open and they convert his body to become the cyber controller. And it's horrible, but it's wonderfully dark as well.
My main memory is how much time was spent establishing the characters of you know, the snow-capped base sort of thing in the first half, and then how ultimately it just rapidly just sort of steered away from them when they weren't featured very much in the second half and dispatched in a very sort of arbitrary way. I found it very uneven, just to be brutally honest. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it a lot. And it's fascinating that was this the only, apart from Mark Gatiss eventually ended up in the show, I mean, was this the only new adventure to be written by then member of the cast? I think it was.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, obviously there was Glyn Jones who wrote The Space Museum and then appeared in Sontaran Experiment, and we had Ian Martyr novelised.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I think you're right, David Banks was...
The only new adventure to be written by, because obviously Ben Aronovich and Andy Cartmell committed, you know, they'd worked on the TV show, obviously Mark Platt, etc. But I think it's interesting, purely from the point of view of like a member of the cast being so... I've always been impressed by the fact that, and I'll be completely respectful, how into it David Banks got.
Yeah.
There's some brilliant, you know, some brilliant writing in his book. I remember a really good documentary in one of the, I think it was the Attack of the Cybermen DVD, about the implications of cyber, you know, the Cybermen and where they came from and replacement spare parts surgery and all that sort of stuff and artificial legs and all that sort of thing. And it's something that's never really gone away. But it's, as a book, I have to be right. The Jade Pagoda, of course, we should talk about that.
Oh.
Which is introduced, and that's records a few points here and there.
Isn't it lovely, that design in the cover?
Yeah, and of course, Andrew used it in the cover of the little brochure on the day leaflet for Novel Experiences last year, didn't he?
He did. Avoid
using a police box and getting done for copyright. Yeah, the Jade Pagoda became quite a popular... Was it not a fanzine even called Jade Pagoda?
Yeah, there was.
And I'm pretty sure that was also the name of one of the members of Little Mix, but I could be wrong. So, we've rabbited on enough. I can't believe he's here. I'm so jealous that Kenny got to talk to him. It's only blooming David Banks.
Well, I'm David Banks. Usually I say hello, Earthlings, before that. But I have played the Cyberman, as Cyberman, and the Cyberleader in Doctor Who. The way I see it is that I've done lots of other things as an actor and as a writer and other things too. But you know how it is in Doctor Who. Everybody hones in on that and they don't think you've done anything else at all. So I'm happy with that. I'm from Doctor Who. I'm a Cyberleader.
Better to be known for something than nothing.
Yes.
In a good way.
That's debatable, I suppose. But anyway, maybe we'll get on to that.
Yes, indeed. So thank you so much for coming on and joining us and chatting about perhaps not the most obvious part of your Doctor Who CV. Many would be thinking we'd be going for Earthshock, Five Doctors, Attack of the Cybermen, or even Silver Nemesis, or perhaps even The Ultimate Adventure. But no, we're going for your new adventure, Iceberg.
Yeah, it's called Iceberg. And it's part of the New Adventure series. Of course, it's no longer a new adventure. But back then, it was the only thing that Doctor Who fans had, wasn't it? Because Doctor Who proper had finished. It had been packed away in a box and wasn't opened again until 2005.
Do you remember how the commission for the book came about? I'd assume it was following on from your excellent book on Cybermen.
It was, in a way. There's a difficulty, I think, for people generally to understand that if you're known for one thing, then you can't do anything else. And so I think it's typical for people to say, oh, you're an actor, so you won't be able to write. You won't be able to write this book. And so I think Cybermen was a kind of proof that I could put words together and I could think about things. Now, I mean, which is a silly thing anyway, but I went to Manchester University. I did drama. People sometimes think that that's learning how to act, but it's not. It's just like how you go to do English literature. It's a kind of subset of English literature. It's an academic course, and you learn how to think about things and to research them yourself and to write about them. So I wanted actually to be a writer as well as an actor from very early on. But I think it surprised people that I was able to produce a book, a theory of Cybermen, say, and think about that. And once I'd done that, then I could suggest to Peter Darvill Evans, who was the editor of this new series coming up, The New Adventures, that I had a plot and I would like to write one of these novels. And he kind of undernarred a bit, but eventually I met him at a convention. And this would have been 1990, I think. And you know, we got talking, and I think he accepted that he could go with it. That's how it sort of started. Once I had the plot, and because it wasn't going anywhere for a year or two, I got together with somebody who was a bit of a young guy. He was very, very interested in making a computer game. And so we started to use the plot for this, for that computer game. It never really went anywhere, but that's what sort of developed the plot in a way. And I got the go-ahead to write the book in 1992. And it was meant to be, I think it was 180,000 words long, something like that. And I wrote it in, I gave myself 6 months away from other work, and I actually got it done in about 3 months.
Wow.
Do you think that's good?
That's amazing.
Is it?
That's absolutely amazing.
Well, I suppose it was bubbling away in my head. And I wrote it on one of those little Sinclair computers, a tiny Sinclair computer, which you could only see the about three lines of text. This is extraordinary, isn't it, now, from the perspective that we have now of computer technology.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. What I really enjoy about this, having reread it in the past couple of weeks, was the fact that an awful lot of the plots, initially we're getting to learn who Ruby is and everything that's going on the cruise, and the fact that the Doctor's involvement is minimal. We get these just wee flashes of him here and there, and then of course it builds up. So that's it, that you're really anticipating what's going to happen. How are these three plot elements going to come together?
Yeah, and I think a contentious part of that development is that the Doctor appears only gradually. I think it's the fourth chapter, which is a very short chapter, where he first comes in. The reason, I think it's been criticized in some quarters because people just want to really have a story about the Doctor, and they think, you know, when they get to the end of the third chapter, they think, well, the Doctor hasn't appeared yet. But I had a very cogent reason for doing that. I wanted very much to understand the mystery of the Doctor as it is for anybody who meets a man who says he can go through time and space in a box, in a police box. You wouldn't believe him. And that's kind of been touched on, I think, had been touched on in one or two stories before. But it's kind of skipped over then. You know, there's the initial thing. But it's part of, you know, what we have to get through in trusting people. So that's a kind of a theme in the novel. How we trust people, how far we trust them, and when is it that we give all our trust to them. And we find at the end of the novel that there's somebody that we've been, we think he's an odd kind of character, but we find that really there was a lack of trust for a long, long time in that character.
I particularly enjoyed the fact that Ruby's grown up to be a journalist. Now, a lot of you mentioned at the start that you've taken the name of Ruby from someone else. Who did you borrow Ruby's name from?
Well, I had a very good friend who's an actor, and she's done a huge amount of stuff. Now, people might know she's called Janine Dubitsky. She's currently in Benidorm. I mean, she does Benidorm every year, goes to Spain or wherever it is, and for the last 8 or 9 years or something. But anyway, at that time, let me see. Yes, Ruby was one of her children. Was the second born, I think, and she was born in 1984, and that's when I set Ruby's birth date as well. So that when the novel, you know, if the novel is set in 2006, I wrote it in 1993. Ruby was born in 84. Both Rubies were born in 84, so it makes her 22. When we come to the time of the novel. So that's where it comes from. And I was told it came out when Ruby was, I'm wrong about Janine's Ruby's age. She was 3, I think, when the book came out. And I sent her a copy, and Janine said, you know, Ruby was wandering around with the book clasped to her chest and saying, I'm in this book. So that was the personal aspect of it. And nothing else Lovely. To do with that Ruby, because she hadn't grown up. Now she's quite a famous actor. And she's in everything on television and some films. Wonderful.
That's wonderful. I always did wonder. So there we go. That's another thing that I enjoyed is the fact that you're linking back to 10th Planet, but it's done in a thematic link. It's not an overt, here we are, snow-capped base and things like that. It's been renamed and it's got a new purpose with the Flipback project. And I have to say, I love the science of that, because I went out and went to my local library long before internet days to read about magnetic polar reversal, because I thought, is this a real thing? And I was intrigued to find out.
Do you mean, so you found out about it through the novel?
Yes.
But yep. And then you saw that it was real and not just made up?
Yes, that was because I wasn't aware of it. So I went and did that old thing of reading a book in a library. Remember when people used to do that?
Yeah, but it's the only thing you could do back then. 1993. All my research for the Cybermen was done like that. You know, local libraries were really very, very useful. There are fewer of them now, unfortunately.
Very, very sad. But it's just so great, sort of that picking on the fact we've got General Cutler's daughter, Pamela, who's following in his footsteps, and she's having a bit of a tough time of things.
She is, and it's interesting. I was at Oxford University yesterday giving a talk, and it's the Doctor Who, the Oxford University Doctor Who Society, and they, from time to time, as a break from their studies, they have an evening watching a Doctor Who story. And yesterday they had Earthshock, and I'd been invited to go, and I gave the talk that I've been developing over the last 15 years. It's quite an academic talk in a sense, so it was ideal for them. But this ties up with Earthshock, because seeing it again, I was aware, this is 1982 when it was shown, there was a concerted effort to try and get as many female roles in the show. And it was set 500 years in the future, Earthshot. And when you think of it, it's almost taken 500 years for female roles in Doctor Who to be seen as unproblematic. So I wanted to have a heroine in my novel, and I wanted to have a protagonist in the scientific field to be female as well. And that's why Pam Cutler is there. She is a kind of response, a counterpoint to the irascible father, the irascible person who says, "I don't like your hair." But it's an adult novel. It's trying to seriously look at the ways that we develop, the way we think about our parents, for example. And then when they die, and the circumstances in which they die, how we change and understand that, you know, there are parts of us that really have been shaped by that person. But can I just go back to the magnetic reversal? Because, yes, it's a kind of hook on which the plot can be based. But for me, the novel is about climate change. And it's a kind of all of these things, the iceberg, the melting, the chunks of ice that come off, which is in the novel is pointed to just very briefly as a result of climate warming, which in 2006, I thought everybody would be convinced that this was what was happening. And when I was writing it 12 years earlier, you know, people weren't. And you'd get these reports of, you know, that when you talk about size of something, huge size of something, it's always the size of the country of Wales, isn't it? So, and I remember in 1993, there was this report of an iceberg the size of Wales had just broken off from Antarctica. And so you have a bit of that in it. But I didn't want to make it that obvious. So it's a kind of metaphor. And the Cybermen in the icebergs coming in is a kind of metaphor for the change that the Earth is going to go through and that we are going to be dreadfully affected by. The magnetic reversal would be, if it happened, an almost instant manifestation of the kind of change that we are facing now. And so that's why this underlies it. Can science, can political bodies get their act together and do something about this? Well, in this novel, yes, they do, to the extent that they've cracked the technology. They hope that they'll be able to move the situation back. So once polarity reverses, their machinery, their technology can reverse it back again before it gets too strong and installs itself as the, you know, the dominant force in the magnetism of the Earth. So that's why I based it on that. But I didn't make it up. It's something which comes up in the news from time to time in newspaper articles and so on, because it will have, if it ever happened, it will have a devastating effect on wildlife, on us, especially as we get more and more dependent on electronics and electromagnetic fields.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's not the only thing that's ahead of its time as well, because of course we had Ruby with her, basically with her mobile phone and digital recorder and everything in one, which was another little bit of prescience.
You're talking about her nano.
I am talking about her nano.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is extraordinary, actually, because, I mean, pure luck, but yeah, I call it nano because it's a nanocom. And just a few months before the novel came out, in 2006 it came out, and in December 2005, Apple actually brought out a little black device called the Nano. Now, that wasn't an iPhone. The iPhone hadn't been invented by Apple quite then. And the Nanocom isn't a phone. And I could have made it a phone. I could have made it use satellite technology. But that wasn't so developed then, although it was always, I remember reading articles in the 80s about how satellites could be put up and that we could have phone systems and so on. I remember a friend of mine, my tutor actually at Manchester, but after I'd left, saying, oh, this is ridiculous. This is never going to happen. Satellites, putting up satellites in order to have communications. In retrospect, I think it was quite good that I didn't make the Nanocom a phone because, you know, it spoils quite a lot of plot points. It would get her out of a lot of situations. She would be safe under the ice, I think. But apart from that, it would just spoil things.
Yeah, yeah. Something I also particularly enjoyed from somebody who's worked in newspapers for most of his life, the character of Straker, being a media baron with an absolute rampant ego and just horrendous, horrendous. You instantly loathe him. And I think you did a great job just capturing that Robert Maxwell, Rupert Murdoch type of press baron type person. Not that I'm saying it is then, because not for a second, but it's kind of like what you'd imagine somebody evil to be.
Yes, but you've got the two models that I was using, but also the name. Do you know where the name comes from?
I was thinking Straker, Commander Straker UFO.
No, it wasn't actually. There was somebody who ran a very successful airline called Laker.
Freddie Laker, Straker, there we go.
Yeah, just so, you know, it's these things come together and it's a type of person, isn't it? Somebody who has enough confidence to just go for it and ride roughshod over people. It's another aspect of what I wanted to explore of how people like that, because I've had experience of that, especially when I was younger, that there are some people who just want to bully you, in a sense. And of course, and they've got quite a lot of development to do as people. Whether they can do it in this life or not is a moot point. But they're kind of the salt of the earth, you know, they're kind of rough diamonds, that sort of thing. So there are things in them to be, and they achieve stuff. But they're funny characters as well. And I just like the outright Australian, you know, bravado of this character. Yeah.
Now, something that I noticed that you put a bit of personal experience in, and it's just a silly couple of lines, but it made me laugh, and I scribbled it down. And just the fact that there's the Wizard of Oz analogy throughout, but at one point we've got the Tin Man, and he's being bolted into the costume, and he can't see unless he turns his head inside the helmet. What on earth could have inspired that, David?
Yes, exactly. It's something that Mark Hardy likes to. Mark is, you know, always gets very nervous before he's doing an interview or, you know, appearing at an event. He says, I don't know what I'll talk about. But he always talks about lots of things, and he's very funny. And he always mentions this fact that if you're in that helmet, you've got the wonderful chance. You can't see much, but you've got the wonderful opportunity of turning your head and looking out of your ear hole and seeing what the person next to you is doing. So that you very rightly and astutely picked that up, that it has the advantage of being a spy, as it were, and the disadvantage of being screwed into that awful helmet.
Yeah. All these 21st century, these Cybermen, they don't know how lucky they have it.
These are Cybermen who have been evolving for 500 years. You know, we 10th planet is set when they are cloth-faced. 500 years later, they become the Cybermen that I played.
The Neomorphs.
Oh, you've done your homework, haven't you? Well done.
I told you last week when we spoke, I loved that book. I read it cover to cover so many times. And it's fantastic. Even photocopied all the pictures of the Cybermen and had them out. I'm such a sad teenager. Anyway, some say I'm still a sad 40-something, but oh well. But no, another thing that I particularly enjoyed is that you definitely had a lot of fun doing the cyber conversion.
Yes. That really goes back to the tomb, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The tomb of Cybermen. And with the kind of humor form or it was called, I don't know if it was called Humiform in Tomb of the Cybermen itself, but it's, you know, it's the kind of human-shaped hollow you're going to. Yes, I did do that. The interesting thing is that Earthshock was an early, I don't know if it was the first Doctor Who program that incorporated history, you know, for the monster that we were seeing, the previous stories. But Earthshock definitely did that. Eric Saywood was very clever in the way that he brought these things in. Just in, remember, the Cyber Leader and the Cyber Lieutenant stand by this console. Strangely low for Cybermen who can't bend over very well. See that Mark has a very difficult time. His head is really bent over, so we can see this. I know that object, he says, Cyber Leader says. And that was a way of bringing in the backstory cleverly. And I wanted to do that in perhaps an even more comprehensive way in this novel. And so that's why it brings in things from 10th Planet and the two and so on. And the conversion, I mean, that's central to how the Cybermen survive. They can't have babies anymore. You know, they've taken away that possibility. The only way they can proliferate is to convert human material. So I wanted to show that to some extent. Yeah.
Poor Bono, the way you tear him apart. Not Sonny Bono, or the one out of U2. Yeah. But, yeah, it's...
I don't know why I called him Bono. Maybe it was U2. But I wasn't into U2, so... But possibly his name was about... I just quite like, you know, the fact that, you know, it's got flesh and bone. Flesh and Bono. Is a real... You know,
I like that.
Is a real... I mean, he's a fantastic character. You know, this thing of the strength of 10 men, which was always the phrase used. I'd make it literal in the fact that 10 men have to move the piston away from the TARDIS, whereas the Cyberman could just do it on his own. But Bono is a large, strong man. And that's a bit of a throwback to Tomb as well. And the fact that his body, the remains of his body, his augmented body, is seen as the basis for, and this is a slightly different thing. I don't think it's been touched on in other Cyberman stories, but actually it's a head transplant. So Bono's poor head is removed. And that's not usual, I don't think, for Cybermen in general. But what's put in its place, and perhaps explains the bulbous nature of the cyber controller's head, is all the knowledge of the cyber race. You know, it's what was in the earlier Cyberman stories was called the history computer. A kind of 60s phrase, history computer. Yeah.
It's wonderful, just that whole section, just the transplanting the section with the coordinator and planner becoming the controller. So, and then it's a little bit of continuity as well, creating something and explaining it, and it does make sense. It makes perfect sense.
It had to fit into the shape of the history that I did for Cybermen, the book Cybermen, the archive. And so, fortunately, I'd done that work. And at the beginning of the novel, I do actually refer to the novel. Yeah, I just there's a note, and then it says. The word cybernetics, where that came from. Oh, yes, it says, in 1988, I attempted in my book Cybermen to draw together the disparate elements of the Cyberman mythos under a cohesive historical and conceptual theory. It is on that theory that the Cybermen of this novel are based. And so that's what I was following.
Well, it works. It absolutely works. Now, the other thing, of course, that I really found fascinating, this is that, of course, we've got the Jade Pagoda.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of Chinese philosophy and such like feeding into it. Mm. And I just thought, this is a man who's very well read, and just bringing that all together. And it does feel very authentically like the Doctor, just a man of peace who's brought into a situation where there's conflict. And obviously he's got to resolve it, but he's never the man who draws arms.
Very kind of you. Yes, to say it's not... It's not because I'm very well read necessarily. It's at that time, it was a kind of central part of how I was making sense of the world. I had started Tai Chi in 1982. So for 10 years, I'd been doing that and trying to, and I'd been fascinated by the I Ching, the Book of Changes. Because Carl Jung himself had given it some credence. He explained, and I fully agree with him, that these methods, which sometimes seem to be, you know, on a shallow understanding of it, they're just fun. They're ways. It's like looking at your horoscope, something like that. What's going to happen to you? That's nothing to do with the tarot or the I Ching. If you're thinking of using it as a way of understanding the situation you're in. So I got more and more drawn to Taoism, and I wanted to show that the central wisdom of all religions, good religions, is based in how you understand the way people work together, the way the universe works. And it seemed to me that if you could make a connection between Lao Tzu, who was one of the original Taoist gurus, and the doctor, why shouldn't the doctor be there? You know, he says at this, the beginning of the novel, I think, says he's 1,000 years old, that would give a sense of opening up the mystery of life, how we understand life. So that's how it came about. It was central. It wasn't just because I was taking something off the shelf and trying to use it in the novel. It was central to the reason I was writing the novel for my own purposes, to try and understand the place that I was at then. And I hope that for some people, the way that Ruby is gradually understanding as she gets to her 22nd birthday. Because I remember feeling when I was sort of that age, I was thinking, I'm getting quite old, which from my perspective now is, and perhaps even yours, it's extraordinary that we think like that. But you know, we, at every age, it's new for us. And we've got to work out who we are, how we've changed, kind of people we were, and what we might become.
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was just to give it an extra level. I mean, obviously, of course, we're all going to enjoy the fact this was the first new adventure to feature a classic monster from the TV show. And I would imagine that you had an awful lot of fun writing the cyber dialogue.
Yes. Yeah. And the thing is, for most of it, it was different dialogue. It was different Cybermen. You see, it wasn't my Cyberman. It was the Cybermen from taking the clues from the previous stories. I had to think of them in that sense and their development as Cybermen. Then, but yes, clearly that is a come on. Having the Doctor in it, having the cyber monsters is one of the goodies, as it were, the undeniable pleasures for any Doctor Who fan. And I hoped that I wasn't going too far the other way, in a sense. That yes, I wanted to have lots of fun. I wanted to have the suspense, you know, the chases in the ice tunnels and all of that. I wanted to have the almost detective-like story that is solved at the end, but only solved for the reader, not solved for any of the characters. But I did want to have this underlying thing, which is to do with how everybody lives life, how we have to face life. Now that, I understand, you know, that may be too, I've freighted it too much. It might sink below the waterline. But that was my risk. That was the risk I had to take. The fact that you wanted to talk to me about it And you clearly read it very, very well. That gives me some hope that it wasn't a total failure.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. Something else I noticed was that with the Elysium being the ship, have you spent much time on cruise ships over the years?
None. None, and I shall not. especially these huge megaliths, monsters that are destroying, you know, part of they're adding to the speeding up of climate change. And so, no, I wouldn't want to do that, though I understand. I can understand they're absolutely wonderful for the people who are on them. The SS Elysium was a rather modest one. It wasn't made for the purpose. It was reconditioned. So, you know, but this is what Laker, this is what our Murdoch lookalike might have thought. I can make some money from this by buying an old ship. And Elysium, of course, is a reference to an ideal world, to a kind of paradise as well.
Yeah.
So I use it rather ironically.
Yeah, I did pick up on that. I did think it was a deliberate choice. I did. Yeah. It was just wonderful. And of course, the conclusion, we do get the wonderful bit with the Doctor having hidden inside one of the chambers, and that, well, he's not hidden, he's been placed inside one that comes out, and then the magnetic flip's taken place, the controller's weakened, and then they can deal with him. And it's just that wonderful imagery of Cybermen in the iceberg at the end, and just thinking, are there more out there? So it's left a bit of an open ending.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't intending writing a sequel, but that was the point, really, of the novel. That's the metaphor extended, that the melting of the ice presages our destruction. In the novel, it's because there are Cybermen in the icebergs. In the life that we're living now, it's because it shows the extent to which the world is changing because of our activities. Now, this is 30 years after the book. I mean, is it 30 years, 35? Almost 30. Well, what is it?
30 years since publication, yeah.
Yeah. My goodness. Yeah, about 35 years since I started thinking about it. And so that's basically it. That it was meant to end like that. And of course, the title of the book, Iceberg, it can be read on several levels as well. I think you haven't mentioned the character of Brack.
Mike, you know, the Brack. Artist.
The artist, yeah. Yeah, the so-called artist. I mean, he was
artist in inverted commas, yes.
Yeah, he was a pop star, and he's changed to be doing something else. And he's got chutzpah. He's got, but he's also got something on his shoulders. He's made bitter, and for reasons we don't quite know. But it's interesting. I wanted to explore that very slightly as well. This strange thing where younger people are often drawn to those who are those older adults who are on the edge, who are a bit scary. And so that, you know, I enjoyed trying to unpack the relationship, why Ruby gets attracted by him.
Right. Having had posters of her on her wall when she was younger, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a kind of, so, yeah. And I suppose, to bring it to kind of personal level as well, at the point I was writing it, you know, I'd had, I don't know, you see, I have done other things other than being in Doctor Who. And I thought Doctor Who, I would be totally anonymous. And for the most part, I was. I'm not so much now, but it's the only thing I'm remembered for. But I had just done Brookside, a year in Brookside, for example, you know, when I was thinking about the novel and writing it. And that was an extraordinary eye-opener, because you suddenly become everybody's property. And so, I was interested in that aspect where somebody like Brack, it's just he becomes a celebrity. He doesn't have to be nice to people, because he knows that people, you know who he is. And he, you know, I didn't want that to happen to me. So I I made a decision, actually, not to do those kind of things that would be, lots of people would see it. And in fact, I came across a Chinese couple of characters, which I translated as meaning live happy, live unseen. And of course, you'd think that would be ideal for a silent, an actor playing a silent, you know, it hasn't quite worked out like that. But I think it's going okay.
Yeah, you mentioned there your Brookside appearance. I remember a cutting I have somewhere in my loft of you from, I think the Sunday Post up here in Scotland did a piece on you, talking about being cyber leader to Brookside. I may still have that. I'll have to dig it out. If I can't find it, I will send it to you.
Thank you. It may be, it's funny, near the end of my time in Brookside, I was in France and I burnt my hand quite badly. And I was coming back to do the next episodes in Brookside. And when I got to the press office, they showed me a big pile of newspaper cuttings. Because Brookside star or whatever, Brookside love interest, a fire, and a French farmhouse. Now, those things, in tabloid terms, are catnip, aren't they?
Totally.
Totally. Yeah. No, but it wasn't just that. It was, you know, that kind of interest. It was, I don't know, it's filmed in Liverpool. I remember going into it, you know, we were put up in hotels and so on. We go up there. I was in the, yeah, I went down to the pool area and having a shower and so on. And I'd come out of the shower and I wasn't wearing anything. And this guy just came up. And I'd just been accused of murdering one of the lead characters, you know. He came up and he started berating me for, and I was standing there in, you know, with nothing on. And I thought, that was when it clicked. I don't have to put up with this, you know. And then not long later, in Islington, I went in with friends to an Indian restaurant on several levels. And as we walked up past one level, there was this group of rowdy men celebrating football or something. And they saw me and they started chanting murderer, murderer, murderer. And it wasn't nice at all.
That's incredible.
So
that's
live happy, live unseen.
Yeah, me, pop cyber leader mask back on and you'll be fine.
Well, I'm thinking of writing it. I mean, I've started writing memoirs of the cyber leader. And I think it'll have to mention bits about my life. I thought of calling it Live Happy, Live Unseen.
I do enjoy that. Now, of course, the book also had an audiobook release from the RNIB, which you performed yourself. How did you find doing that?
I found it a bit scary at the beginning. I've recorded lots and lots of audiobooks, and I had by that time recorded, I don't know, 40 or so. And I just wondered whether I could do justice to these characters. They were in my head, but some of them I'd sort of vocalized to try and get a handle on them, but I just wondered whether I'd be able to keep it up. And I think it was okay in the end. But what I wanted to do, which I'd done to some extent with the Cyberman book, which I did record, that wasn't so difficult for me to record. I mean, I wasn't so nervous about it because it wasn't narrative. But when you're doing a narrative audiobook as opposed to a nonfiction, you know, you've got to play all the characters. With nonfiction, with an autobiography or whatever, you're advised not to try and characterize people. But when you're doing a novel, then you are. You're each person. And I thoroughly enjoy it. It's one of my, you know, favorite jobs to read a book, because you're in control, basically. I mean, the producer can say, oh, hey, we'll have to go back on that bit or whatever. But you create the character, what you think is the audible account of the character. And so I got to play all those characters. And what I did with Cybermen was to take the central archive part of it, that's why it's called the archive tapes, and make it more like a film, like you were listening to the audio track of a film score. And with Iceberg, the audiobook, which I hope will be coming out, I hope the BBC will be bringing this out, they hope to be starting the New Adventures as a series. And it, in my discussions, it sounds as though Iceberg, which is a complete audiobook all ready to go, might be there first.
Fantastic. Or excellent, I should say.
Excellent, yeah.
But just when you mentioned the archive tapes there, I've suddenly just remembered the names of archivist Hegelia and Druscilia. Yeah. I've just popped into my head. I told you I read that book a lot.
That is amazing. Archivist Hegelia actually appears in another New Adventures.
Yes.
Did you know that? The author wrote to me to ask for permission.
That's right. Doesn't she get killed off or something while she's doing her... Or she gets turned into a Cyberman.
Does she really? I don't know. I never read the
novel. I'm sure she does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hegelia, yeah. So, you know, another... A lot of my writing is channeling female characters, strangely. I read a play not so long ago called Five Marys. And it just had five women in it called Mary. So I don't, you know, it's definitely part of my character, a part of, you know, who I am. I think because I was an only child and my mother probably really wanted a daughter, or, you know, she wanted quite a few children, but as I was the only one, maybe I had to do both sides.
Can't improve in perfection, David. I've got a younger sister, so
perfection may come along a little longer. Yes, a little later. Yes, you wait hours and hours for perfection, days and days, years and years, and then three examples of it come along all at once.
So, how do you look back on Iceberg now? Because it's a lot of it is so ahead of its time, and it's one that definitely makes the reader think. I think I believe that's very much the case.
In what way would you say it was ahead of its time?
I think the fact that, you know, you're taking these ecological concerns, likes of global warming, taking that and putting it in there and putting it front and centre in the book. And it's an absolutely core part, because without that element, the rest of it wouldn't happen. And I think that's...
I wonder whether, I mean, it's an underlying theme. And as I said, I'm using elements of the story as a kind of metaphor for climate change, because at the time climate change, you know, was highly contested, and it's always, as it is now with AI, it's always the people who are going to make money out of denying something or saying that something is risky. Those two sides, you've got to understand what is real and ascertainable, confirmable, and what is just made up as to scare you. So I kept it in the realms. I kept the idea of climate change kind of deep down. It's that 9/10 of the iceberg that you never see. But yeah, I am. It is interesting that some of the themes in it are still very, very much with us. I mean, you just mentioned the cruise. One thing, you know, the it was beginning to be popular then, but I didn't expect it to be as popular as it is and how damaging it is now. And yes, the nanocom. But there's also, you know, religious fundamentalism has really become, I mean, we're in the middle of it now. It's, I don't know, it's every time, every day you wake up and you hear the news or you read the papers, it is, I hesitate to use the word despair, but we can't despair. We can't despair, but there is such a mountain to climb in trying to resolve the situation in the Middle East is really what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But no, David, I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting, and I'd like to say thank you so much for taking the time to come on and discuss a rather fantastic book.
Thank you very much, Kenny. It's been an enormous pleasure. Thank you.
And can I just say, Dave, he's brilliant. You've heard him there. He was so enthusiastic. before we did the interview, we'd arranged a chat. We were going to have a quick chat so David could get to see what I'm about. Uh-huh. But I'm a good guy.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I think I am.
Kenny's a good guy. We all know this.
Thank you. And we had a wonderful chat for about an hour, just chin-wagging.
Cool.
And he's wonderful. David is just such a real pleasure to interview. And if anybody's organising a convention, he's a guy you should have along because he's thoughtful, he's intelligent, and my God, he's so, so funny as well.
I've never met him. I'd love to because the Cyber Leader was, you know, he was a big part of the show back in the day. You know,
character.
Especially, you know, for fans of our age. I mean, I was 9 when Earthshock went out, I was 15 when Nemesis went out, and he appeared in 4 stories across that, you know, across that period. And the characterisation of his leaders is fascinating. I mean, he was like, you know, he was Doctor Who's Darth Vader. There's no two ways about it. He was. And if you're listening, Mr. Banks, thank you so much. We you know, on behalf of, you know, 9-year-old to 15-year-old me, who loved you back in the day and had posters of you on the wall and just, you know, attempted to draw you so many, or draw your character so many times, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I hope you'll come back on at some point and I can maybe jump in on the conversation.
Yes, David is just wonderful, great company.
Thank you.
And so is Mr. Banks as well. And we shall no doubt speak to both of you more in future. But Dave.
Yes, Kenny.
This Dave who is here, not David.
Yes.
We're now going to have a quick look to see what some reviews had to say.
Good.
And I believe that you've got something in your mitts there.
Yes. Well, as we've been doing, listeners, where appropriate, we're reading the review from Lars Pearson's excellent I Who, Volume 1. So let's have a look at what they have to say about Iceberg on page 188. At the end of the day, Sayo is like the Titanic. Uh-oh. The book's first half features neither the Doctor nor his companions, and we're flayed with the pointless characterisation of Antarctic base members. There's too much rehashing of irrelevant cyber history, and exactly what the hell the Cybermen want is never clear. Only in the tenacity and spirit of Ruby Duval, she could have made a fine companion, does Iceberg redeem itself, but this alone can't save this tedious and unnecessarily crude work. Well, that's very harsh.
I agree. I think, I mean, I obviously, with new adventures, you come to them with an expectation. You think, this is a book that's got the Cybermen in it, and you expect them to be here, there, and everywhere. And they're not.
Making each day of the year.
Yeah, they're working in the background. And I do like the fact that we've got a sequel to The Tenth Planet here with a lot of the characters. There's Pamela Cutler, who's obviously the daughter of General Cutler.
Yeah.
And we've got, and there's that lovely end joke with the with the crew members named like Whitehead, Palmer.
Sure, of course, yes.
Like, which I thought was quite a good little gag.
The thing is, if you watch some of the old stories, like The Invasion, they're not in it very much. In the moon base, they're not front and centre. Wheel in Space, they're not in it at all. It's more about the character dynamic. So I think in that way, Iceberg is quite authentic. Now, before we go any further, this is probably a good point to drop in a little insert.
Yes, let's hear a little excerpt from the talking book version, which David recorded for the RNIB, the Royal National Institute for the Blind. And we'll hear a little excerpt from that now, courtesy of Mr. Banks.
Ruby was about to return to the Doctor when she froze. 3 Cybermen were striding out of the backstage darkness onto the stage. They had not spotted her. They were making for the Doctor. One of them raised a gun. There was a flash. The central glowing oval shattered. The Doctor jumped back in shock. The Cyberman spoke.
You are known to us. We have encountered you before.
The Doctor raised his hands above his head and turned slowly to face the intruders.
You are recorded in our history computer as hostile to the cyber rays.
I bet I am, muttered the Doctor.
We have captured your travelling machine. It has extensive interior dimensions. We will utilize it for the transportation of our captives. You will cooperate.
I shouldn't be too sure, said the Doctor.
The Cyberman continued, regardless of the interruption.
You will meet the Cyber Controller.
Oh, yes, said the Doctor with some surprise. I thought he wasn't invented yet.
The Cyberman seemed to pause for thought, as if confused by the Doctor's weird time-travelling syntax.
Ruby wondered who or what this cyber controller was. As if on cue, the Cyberman spoke again.
The cyber controller is a new conversion,
buzzed the Cyberman.
We will survive. We will proliferate and survive.
As the synthetic voice droned on, Ruby crept up behind one of the other two Cybermen. She was concealed by the black drapes hanging in the wings. In her palm were the deadly links of gold. She picked one up between finger and thumb, and, hardly daring to breathe, snaked her hand round the cyber chest. She dropped it, neatly, inside the metal mesh of its vent. She moved back and waited. Nothing happened. She thought she might have missed. She tried a second time. She heard the small tinkling noise of the link dropping down inside the workings of the panel. The Cyberman looked up into the black space above the stage as if something had fallen from there. Then it pressed a button on its panel. There was a small rush of air, and the link was ejected onto the stage. What a pain, she thought, beginning to panic. The doctor was wrong. It doesn't affect them in the slightest. What to do now?
Thank you very much for giving us your permission to use that, David.
Awesome.
And of course, please do have a look at the RNIB website because they do a lot of incredible work to help those who are visually impaired to be able to enjoy books in the way that we can.
Absolutely. Again, just shows what a good guy David Banks is now. So that probably wraps it up for Iceberg. It's another one to add to the list that I'd like to properly revisit. It's always interesting talking about these books again because you think, like, how much do I remember? How much do I not remember? Let's find the time. But anyway, Kenny's going to be back tomorrow with Day 8.
Yes, I'll be joined by Matt Michael from Doctor Who Magazine and occasionally Pieces of the Eighth as well. And yes, we'll be chatting about an Eighth Doctor book. But which one? There's only one way to find out.
Yes, you'll have to tune in tomorrow. I'll see you in a couple of days, probably, all being well. Now, before we go, Kenny, you can ask me a question.
I am.
Dave, yes, Kenny.
The question I'd like to ask you is, what is your favourite new adventure that features the Cybermen?
I'm trying to think if there are any other ones. They're not. So what, Iceberg's the only one they did?
Yeah.
That's amazing. The restraint.
Yeah.
I've forgotten that. The restraint is amazing. This is what we've said this in the past, though, about new adventures. They could have done the cash-in thing of having TV monsters in every single book, but no, they did new and exciting and interesting things.
Too broad and too deep.
Indeed. Of course Iceberg is. But yeah, I'll have to do some more Cybermen. But I wonder if when are the Cybermen going to be in the telly? Again, it feels like ages. Anyway, Kenny, you've got to ask me a question.
Yes, the question is, do you think we should play out with a tune?
And no, I don't, because I'm always worried about copyright strikes. But we're going to play out with Sugar-Coated Iceberg by the Lightning Seeds, who I managed to crowdsurf to at the Barras in 1996. Listeners, there's a fascinating fact for you.
That's cool.
I'll be back in a few days. Cheerio.
We should maybe send the people at iWho a sugar-coated iceberg to maybe cheer them up a bit.
They probably could do with it.
Miserable gits.
Absolutely.
Isn't it lovely, that design in the cover?
Yeah, and of course Andrew used it in the cover of the little brochure, as it were, for Novel Adventures last year. There's
what,
today's
sorry?
Novel Adventures, of course. That's what it's called. Right. That's your outtake. This is the stuff Peter has to deal with on a daily basis. Right. They could have done the cash-in thing of having TV monsters in every single book, but no, they did new and exciting and interesting things.
Too broad and too deep.
Indeed. Like Kenny's bum.
Cut.
But no, yes.
That's not even going as an outtake. That's outrageous.
Look at you laughing. I'm laughing at you laughing. No, don't put it out. Don't necessarily. Right.